Hello to our listeners. Welcome to the Women Governance Trailblazers podcast, where we listen to the journeys of trailblazing women in the corporate governance field, their passions, struggles, and commitment to improving how companies and boards function. My name is Liz Dunchy, and my co-host is Courtney Camlett.
Hello, everyone.
Courtney and I are both passionate about governance, and we want to spotlight some of the trailblazing women who share that passion. We love connecting with guests from different paths and industries to hear their perspectives on what surprised them in their career and where they think the field of corporate governance is going. For this episode, we are delighted to be talking with Donna Anderson. Donna is the Global Head of Corporate Governance at T. Rowe Price. And if you don't know Donna, you probably do, but she's a luminary in the corporate governance field. She has spent nearly 2 decades leading T. Rowe's proxy voting and engagement efforts and incorporating governance considerations into the firm's investment research process. Prior to joining T. Rowe, she was Director of Equity Research for Invesco Funds in Houston. Donna has held leadership roles in numerous industry organizations in the investment, finance, and corporate governance field through the years. She's leaving the firm this year, and we are very happy that she is taking time to talk with us about her career and corporate governance insights. We're thrilled to speak with you, Donna. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks to you both for inviting me.
We're so excited to have you here and to learn more about your career path. For example, how did you get started in the field of corporate governance? What pivotal moments led you to becoming the head of corporate governance at T. Rowe Price? And as a leader, visionary and a trailblazer, what has been your compass for decision making?
Well, as with a lot of career paths, it's kind of one door opens and you walk through it and you never know. You don't know that you're on a path until you look backward. But I actually started out as a newspaper reporter of all things way back in the day, and eventually kind of found my way to an interest in investments and a decision to go to business school. And so after that, I was an investment analyst for a few years and found my way to Invesco, where I was eventually a director of research. And so this is the 90s, and this is one division of Invesco. And back then, for them, what director of research meant was really running the business of research, right? So it was a hodgepodge of responsibilities. I did summer internships and fall recruiting and broker relations, because back then we had research commissions that needed to be managed. And then my boss came to me one day and said, "Oh, we want you to do this proxy voting thing too. Don't worry about it. It's only April and May, and it's just it'll just take a couple weeks, and nobody really cares." And
Easy
exactly, just
peasy, right?
carve out some extra time in May to read some stuff and do all of our proxy voting. And it was, shall we say, in those days, this was the AIM division of Invesco. It was a momentum shop, and so we didn't own stocks by and large for years and years. We owned them for months and months, and so just a very different world. And I thought of it as just kind of part of what I did. I'll just do it in the spring, but I really came to like the proxy voting part. I just thought it was so interesting. And in the 90s in the US, we didn't really have much in the way of shareholder rights. There weren't that many like explosive kind of cases, but I just thought it was so interesting that we got to kind of vote on these directors every year, and once in a while on some weird bylaws, once in a while a contest or a like a gnarly M&A kind of situation would arise. So I just really took an interest in it, and I did that for 10 years, that portfolio of responsibilities. And then one day, honestly, really out of the blue, a friend told me, "Hey, like that stuff you like doing, it's called corporate governance, right? Because I just saw that T. Rowe Price is looking for a full-time corporate governance specialist." To my knowledge, it was the first firm to decide that this was a specialty, and that that they really needed help in this area, and that they were ready to kind of dial up, our dialogue, T. Rowe's dialogue with issuers. And that was just honestly just a lucky break. It was a pivotal moment, but I had nothing to do with it. Just a friend, looking out for me.
A true trailblazer.
I guess so. I guess so. We kind of invented, I think we invented some things here. So I kind of like packed up my 4-year-old and my house and moved to Baltimore, and the market immediately crashed. I got here in late 07, and it was right as the financial crisis was hitting. So the vision of the role as it was laid out pre, 2008, and then what happened afterward were quite different, but we sort of adapted. And as you both know well, everything kind of changed after that, right? As shareholder proposals, shareholder rights did get really quite a bit strengthened and empowered. Shareholders were sort of expected by regulators around the world to take responsibility to make sure that something like that wouldn't happen again. Risk management, of course, the rise of ESG, all of this stuff came out of sort of a rethinking post-financial crisis of the role of shareholders in the chain. And of course, now it's not new. Everybody has, corporate governance specialties. So that's kind of how it happened. And it was a very lucky break for me. And as you said, Liz, I've been here in the same role, actually 18 years. In terms of the compass, I'm still a believer, always have been, in active management. And so there's just really one compass for me all these years, which is what's right for the company, what's right for the shareholders of this company, sort of over our expected investment time horizon. And I'm, pretty old school in my definition of what's material and what's financially oriented and what's really relevant. And so just trying to boil down a lot of these issues, which are often, let's face it, kind of academic kind of debates in corporate governance, and trying to really put our resources behind what are the few things of this big pile that might, really matter to this company, and being very bottom up and company specific about it. That's my whole framework.
That's a great framework to hear from a securities lawyer perspective. So thank you for sharing that. And you've touched a little on this already, but what do you think has changed the most? And also, what has stayed the same over the time that you've been involved in the investment and corporate governance world? And has there been any big surprises along the way for you?
It's funny. I mean, about this is like, I think it might be my 28th proxy season. I don't like to think of it. I don't like to do the math that much, but there is definitely a cycle. There's definitely a pattern to a job like this, right? This is what you do in the spring, and then you do reporting in the summer, and then you do engagement. And then, like, there's a very distinct calendar to it and cadence. And in that sense, it can be sometimes it feels like nothing is changing. There are certain companies, every year I open the proxy, every year I hope that there might be some change in some area that we've been talking to the company about for years. And every year it's like, no, nothing is changing, just absolutely nothing. If anything, maybe they're going backward in terms of their comp practices, let's say, or something that we think is important that the company just really disagrees on. And you do, I do every year have moments where it feels like beating your head against a wall, like nothing's ever going to change. But when you step back and you look at the portfolio as a whole, and you look at, changes through time, there's just no debate that it is a very different environment, than it was even when I started at T. Rowe, much less the dark ages before that. It's shareholder rights are entirely on a whole new plane here and in many markets around the world. The responsibilities that come with that, shareholders, in my view, have struggled with how to execute those responsibilities well, and we're still in that struggle. But there's just no question that sort of that's been a rebalance of, I don't know if power is the right word, but just sort of influence between like a pure management sort of view, more board influence, and then shareholder influence, and how we balance those kind of voices. So when you step back, you can clearly see the change. The surprises along the way, Liz, to me, have been like company specific kind of things. Like, I don't know that, I mean, every once in a while, we all get surprised by a memo or a regulation or, I don't know, some sort of market event or something like that. But for me, the ones that kind of stand out over time are like, you walk into a meeting that you think is going to be fine, and it turns out to be like really contentious. It turns out, the company's coming in loaded for bear, and we just didn't know that. Or, contest that everyone thought was going to be a big deal and turns out to be, a nothing at all. Or companies that we just like, those hitting my head against the wall companies, one day you do open the proxy and see, oh my gosh, everything, like they decided to change. They decided, that it was the whatever they were afraid of before, they're over it, and they've, turned over a new leaf or something. So there's always those kind of surprises, which is why I like this job. It's the same job, It's the same cycle every year, but it's so interesting because the companies keep changing and keep surprising us.
Yeah. Do you think some of those surprises are precipitated by changes in management or the board, or is it just that they've thought about changes for a long time and have come around to the idea that it's in the best interest of the company?
If there's a pattern to it, the one I've noticed most often is the company has reached some new level of security, I'd call it, or maturity or whatever. And it's a fair argument. So, for example, like a biotech, right? There's a phase, and it can be a very long one. Their maturity isn't necessarily measured in years, right? They might be in a very long phase where they're pre-commercial for a decade. Then they have a product, right? Or they license something or whatever. So then they're kind of in a new phase, and their market cap might also be in a whole new ballpark. So sometimes we look at companies in terms of, well, you've had a lot of years to develop your corporate governance or to develop a board that's more sort of in line with a company that's been public, let's say, for 15 years. That's not always the right way to look at it, because the companies themselves reach these sort of giant phases, or they scale in some different way. And so it's usually something like that, where they sort of look back, they've got a few years under their belts, they're in a new part of the S&P universe, let's say. And then they kind of go, okay, we don't have to be as protected as we were before. Like, now we have size on our side, or now we have our own, now we're profitable, or whatever it is that made them feel vulnerable. They don't feel vulnerable anymore.
The only constant is change, right? And with that comes a reassessment of governance priorities.
You would hope. Exactly. Yeah, I think it is appropriate to, when the company realizes it's in a whole new, maybe you look around and see, oh, we've really turned this board over. Let's rethink some other things as well and make sure they still make sense. Yeah.
So, looking into your crystal ball, because everybody wants one of those, and considering the potential impact of universal proxy advisor regulations, shifting shareholder proposal dynamics, and the overall environment, do you think there will be significant shifts in corporate governance in the next few years?
Well, you are both in a great place to observe this as well, so I'm curious if you're going to disagree with me here. But I think we are in a pretty big shift right now, and I think it's probably overdue. So I guess where I would start is maybe 5, 6, 7 years back, there's a couple things happening, right? As I mentioned, post financial crisis, all the rules have changed. Shareholders have been empowered. Everybody built these giant stewardship teams. And my observation is that shareholders have not always adapted to that newfound power with grace, shall we say. There's just it's just it goes to your head sometimes, honestly, when you're like holding the power to cast a vote that really matters to a company, and I don't know. It hasn't been always handled well by shareholders. And let's face it, shareholders are wrong about a lot of things, right? We are pretty trend following. We are kind of pack animals sometimes. And there are, moments in the market, and I would say both in stewardship land and in, kind of fundamental analysis land, where shareholders, price in or assume in a lot of things that turn out to be wrong. At the same time, what's been happening, of course, is subscale players on the asset management side and active managers such as T. Rowe on the asset management side have been losing market share, and all of those flows have been concentrated in a very few, very large, passive managed firms. And so that just meant that their market power in these kind of settings, votes and things like that, I mean, increased really fast and into a huge degree. And I think companies kind of, observed that and got nervous and did not feel that they had the sway, to say, no, that religion that you're pushing on us, whether it's ESG or corporate, governance, kind of these principles-based things that investors by and large like to push on all companies, when it wasn't a fit, companies did not feel that they kind of had the right to stand up. One example I like to use is incorporating ESG factors into your compensation plan. Companies kind of got the message a few years ago that they all needed to do that. A lot of them did it, but without real conviction. They didn't do it well. They didn't really want to do it. It's academically, in my view, questionable whether that's even a good idea. Now here we are unwinding it, right? So why do companies do that? Well, there was that kind of moment a few years ago where I just don't think companies felt like they really could, push back on their highly concentrated, like the way that their shareholder base had kind of stacked up. So totally different world now, right? We have regulatory things pushing back on that. We have kind of a political movement. And I do think we have investors who've just kind of matured and being a little more thoughtful about like, wait, maybe maybe some of those ideas we pushed are turning, and again, ESG and comp is turning out to be sort of not supportable from a from an empirical, from an outcomes kind of standpoint. So sort of okay to say, hey, we were kind of wrong about that, or a little more deference to management, who, let's face it, they know the company's the best. So that's what I see shifting. I don't think it's just political. I don't think it's this moment in time. I think there's kind of a broader multi-year shift happening, which is, hold on, investors got a little too forceful and a little too cookie cutter in kind of what we were pushing, and that doesn't work, across industries. Let's be a little more patient in these kind of things, and let's have more. And at the same time, of course, boards have gotten better over this time. Like, boards are one of the things, to the earlier question, that have changed a lot. They're just much higher quality, I would say. It's safe to say now versus, say, 20 years ago. So it's appropriate, I think, for investors to kind of dial back on the preachiness and dial up on the let's give them some time to kind of demonstrate that this particular decision is right for them, even if it might be unorthodox. I think we need a lot of that, and I think we're going to get a lot of that over the coming years.
I do hope that holds true because, especially with the universal proxy card rules, I think companies are even more nervous about activism situations and needing the support from their institutional investors and asset managers on everything so that they have this relationship of trust and there aren't wedge issues that the activist can use in a contest or something like that. It's kind of like it's coming, like on the one hand, everybody's maturing, and hopefully learning from this lesson that businesses are unique and we need to trust the people who are running the business. But then on the other hand, there's still this threat of like it's a little bit easier to run a proxy contest these days.
It is easier and cheaper to run a contest. I am not persuaded that it's easier or cheaper to win one. So there's always, of course, examples that will, the exceptions that will like prove me wrong. But I do think that the level of worry about universal proxy and just activism in general is outsized relative to the actual
Oh,
level of
that's
risk.
reassuring. So I loved your background that you shared earlier, Donna, about your career path and how much you loved the proxy process. And obviously there's a lot to love there. And it's kind of a lesson in like do the job that you want to do, and then the universe will bring it to you. So it's just wonderful to hear that. What has been your favorite part of leading T. Rowe's proxy voting and engagement process over these years?
Yeah, that's really hard to pinpoint. Obviously, I wouldn't have stayed 18 years if I didn't think it was actually the best job in the company. So there's a lot of there's a lot, like I said, it's always interesting. I don't ever remember being bored. And what I personally just have really enjoyed is the luxury of being a subject matter expert, right? And we have a lot of those at T. Rowe. We have analysts, who cover the same stocks or the same sectors for their whole careers. Like, the luxury to be deep and not that wide is great. And I love that structure here. It's just so being able to really develop a specialty. So we have a very integrated process here. Most people know that portfolio managers and analysts are quite involved. And so the people is, of course, one of the answers. That's what's great about this job. But what I didn't really expect, and what has become, I mean, actually the best thing about it, is the external network. The fact that, I mean, honestly, I don't even think my closest relatives could explain what I do. They don't know what this world is, right? But there's, 100 people that I know in my network that know exactly what that is. Like they have the same job sitting somewhere else in some other investment firm. They know exactly what it's about. They know what the season's about. They know what I mean when I say, oh, that contest next week. Like we're all thinking of the same stocks. And we have forums, well, like the one you used to put together, and CII, and we have a thing called Governance Week, and just women's networks. The ability to get together with communities of people who know exactly what your day-to-day life is like has been such a joy, developing and that network. And of course, it's a pretty small community. People go from firm to firm, and you're able to continue seeing them. That part is actually really fun, and I have made such great friends through that part, spread out, all over the couple of continents, which is great. That I think that has to be my favorite thing.
I would say governance is a very collaborative group of people. Everybody is always willing to share and learn from others. So that is extremely helpful.
That is so true. Yeah, that must be part of it. It's not, there are other communities where investors get together, but it's a little more, everyone's a little more proprietary or, secretive, and you want to hear stuff, but you want to tell stuff. You're right. Our group is, we all benefit from kind of just sharing whatever we're struggling with. And that you're right. That is a big part of why it's as tight as it is, I think.
And we're also a group that engages. Speaking of engagement, and I'm a firm believer in engaging with your external shareholder base. For companies that don't have established engagement programs, how would you describe the value of building relationships with stewardship teams? And how does this differ from their analyst interactions? Also, what is a good way to build relationships when the stewardship teams are busy year-round with companies that are at near-term risk of negative votes?
Okay, I'm going to give you some answers that are going to sound cynical, if that's allowed. It's just coming from years of experience. First of all, I would say let us manage our expectations of what it's not going to get you. I am always bothered, honestly, by advice that I hear. Obviously, we all know there's like a cottage industry of advisors, right, sitting in between companies and their shareholders and giving them a lot of tips about exactly this kind of question. And I do hear those advisors frequently say the blue sky argument, right? Like, get to know your shareholders now when it's clear skies, because then when you really need them, they'll take your call. And it'll be easier if you have an activist show up, or if you need, you have an ISS thing and you need them to support you or whatever. I don't think that's true. I don't think there is insurance here that you're investing in when you start an engagement program. And the reasons are we don't vote in favor of companies because we like the people. Like that's sort of a weird assumption. We all do have our views and policies and processes about things like that. I don't know if it really helps you when it comes to like a contest or activism or M&A or something. The company has introduced a new level of optionality, right? So the whole, even if we've been engaging for years, now if you're asking me, should the company split up, or should the company be sold, or should the company, whatever the big questions are in these contests, those are not things we've covered in the past, right? And so the whole set of options that have opened up do change the dialogue, and all that previous dialogue I don't think helps. And then the other thing is, of course, other than me, I've been sitting in the same chair 18 years. There's a lot of movement. So the person you engaged with last year probably isn't in the chair 2 years from now. And I don't, what are you really building? So let us just say I'm a little skeptical about the whole proposition that engagement as an insurance measure is time well spent. I question that.
I love your skepticalness. I've been with a couple different companies, and I will agree that it's not to be used as insurance. And people do rotate roles, so you may build a relationship with one Donna, and she may leave, and But I've learned that if they want to talk to you, they'll find you, regardless of the relationship you may or may not have already built. So.
Exactly. It has to be, I think it should be less time driven, right? Like, oh, it's September, we got to call T. Rowe Price again, and more event driven. Like, we don't necessarily have to meet every year if things are pretty steady state. But then in your moment of need, yeah, I can probably find you and you can probably find me. And then, of course, we'll set aside time. So So I think there are some issues with just the way people think about engagement.
I do have one question on that, and Courtney, correct me with if I'm wrong, but I get the impression that part of the value of having a relationship and solid point that people are leaving, and so maybe there isn't much value there, but is that like if something big does come up, you don't have to rehash the entire strategy of the company and explain all the corporate nuances and things like that. So, do you think that if there's a proxy contest or something, is that the point in time when the investors' stewardship teams working with the portfolio managers are going to just evaluate the whole picture at that time and kind of set aside what they've learned in the past, or because it's a unique new issue?
Yeah, I mean I not in every case obviously, but yeah, a lot of the time you kind of have to start at the floor anyway, right? Because
Yeah,
you are
makes sense.
trying to tell the whole story. You're also, in those situations speaking, like in our example, that's a case. So let's say it's a company we've owned a long time, all of a sudden they have a big hairy, proxy contest ahead of them. Well, then you've got lots of analysts in the room, maybe some new associate analysts. You've got different fund managers who may or may not have owned it in the past, but they're in it.
Yeah.
There's a new thesis out there, right, on the company now. So honestly, you have to start from the ground up anyway,
Yeah.
in these
Yeah.
cases. Same thing with ISS. I mean, that's that, like the special situations team there is experienced, but they move people around too. Like you kind of have to tell the whole story anyway. Now, what I do hear is investors get irritated if I've owned the stock for 10 years and the first time I've ever heard from you is because you need something from me, is because, ISS voted against your pay and now all of a sudden you want to speak to me. I do get that, and that is for many a source of annoyance. I think there are ways around it, which include engagement, for instance, that's less frequent. Or my favorite thing, honestly, only like five companies do this. My favorite thing is I get an email in March. Hey, here's what we did last year. Here's the board highlights. Here's our summary. Here's how we think we're doing. We're filing our proxy now. We're happy to talk to you if you want, but we don't need to. We're not asking you for anything. We're just giving you this summary and letting you know we're here. I love that, right? Like you care and I've heard from you and we do track those and save those, but I don't need to spend an hour if I really don't have anything that I'm worried about. Like
Yeah.
just those kind of preventative things could also be
Yeah.
part of the picture.
Yeah, and I find that something similar where after the proxy's filed out off season, right? You send a note and say, hey, here's some things that changed this year. You know, we have a chance to discuss with you if you want. If not, we completely understand. And you kind of give them an outline and some detail so that it's not just, hey, let's have a call. And then it can be up to the investor to determine whether or not to engage.
Yeah, but I appreciate the ones that come with a little bit of content. 'Cause yeah, sometimes we get an email that like IR or something that says, hey, if you want to talk to us, we're here. That's not that helpful. But something that comes actually with a substantive summary and gives me a sense of what's going on. And then I decide, do I need more or am I good? Those are just so helpful. And again, pretty scalable, right? You can send the same message all over. So I love those sort of solutions. But to the question about how, like, okay, if you really do need some time, how do you get that? I do think companies need a dual track approach. I've never worked for a passive investor before, but I have the impression that their scale and processes and the size of their teams and the size of their portfolio and everything is so different that, and they don't have this structure that we have, which is everybody's quite narrow in their specialty but deep, right? We have people that the company already knows they can reach into. So I think you need kind of one strategy for your passive investors and one for the active. And honestly, to be kind of, again, sort of cynical about it, what works is playing on our egos, is saying, you're a wise investor, you're one of our valued investors, and we need your advice on this question. I mean, I do think people love that. And whether the company plans to follow the advice or not, framing it in that way, like we're in this pickle and you see this kind of thing all the time. We would love to hear your perspective on our particular dilemma. I mean, I think that's the way that's your intro.
All
That
right,
works on me
folks, you've heard it here, the
anyway.
way to an investor's heart for governance engagement.
Yeah, Courtney, I think I saw you taking some notes over there.
Absolutely.
Donna, you've had, as we mentioned, an illustrious career, and we'd love to hear the advice that you have for the next generation of women governance trailblazers.
Well, this kind of question makes me feel old, or at least the answer I'm going to give it will probably seem
I don't mean to imply that you're old, just that you've accomplished a lot.
Thank you. I appreciate that. No, it's my issue. I think the questions about women's leadership are, I do think they break down into very different experiences by generation. As I'm just trying to sort of set that table. Like, I think my daughter's graduating from college now. She's 22. She is going to experience, she has a different expectation. She's just going to experience things a lot different than the way it was when I started in the 80s in the newspaper business. So my experience, again, as maybe on the older end of the governance community, has been, frankly, that I don't think there are that many men in my sort of seniority level who are genuinely invested in advocacy for women, true mentorship, sponsorship. You obviously meet some, and you should absolutely, hold on to those and develop those relationships as much as you can. But my experience has been women are the best advocates for women. And I have emphasized my all women's networks over these years. Governance happens to be a field that's probably more than majority women leading these programs. That's one of the things I like about it. I have found our community actually very supportive of each other and helping each other get jobs and helping each other with visibility. And hey, I can't do that panel, but I'll give you three names who can. And just all those things that we can do to kind of promote women that we think are doing a great job. And you can call it unfair and you can definitely call it a dated view, but I think it's more rare to find that kind of real advocacy from our male colleagues. And so that's where I have chosen to put my energy is in my networks of women, both within the firm and outside.
Well, thank you so much, Donna. You are a true luminary, and we really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Thank you.
For those who are listening, we want to thank you as well. Liz and I will be taking a brief summer hiatus and will return in September. Please subscribe to Women Governance Trailblazers on whatever platform you use for podcasts, and we would love it if you would rate us while you're there. In addition, if you know a Women Governance Trailblazer who you think would be a great guest on the show, feel free to ping Liz or me on either LinkedIn or by email.